At 9 on the Friday Radio Zine, hear a pilot of a new Jewish-Palestinian program with a focus on the Israel-Palestine conflict, co-hosted by Hala Goris and Will Seaman. They'll feature an interview with Elan Pape, professor at Haifa University. They'll also speak with Diana Botu, legal advisor to the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. At 10, we'll hear the best of the whole community's radio project workshops. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, Senator Patrick Leahy and Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights react to yesterday's decision by the Senate to give President Bush extraordinary power to detain and try prisoners in the so-called War on Terror. And in an interview with the author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, a behind-the-scenes account of the Bush administration appointees who ran Iraq after the U.S. invasion. Stay tuned.
Subvert KABU's upcoming membership drive by renewing your membership in our fall sweepstakes, where you could be the lucky winner of a $2,000 shopping spree all around Portland. KABU is offering $200 gift certificates from 10 local businesses as the sweepstakes prize. These businesses include Bike Central Co-op, Buffalo Gardens, Cotton Cloud Futons and Furniture, Higgins Restaurant and Bar, Mirador Community Store, Oregon Mountain Community, Portland Saturday Market, The Rebuilding Center, Spa Wilhelmina, and Susan Hebert Imports. If you're a KABU member, you should have already received your entry form in the mail. Entering KABU's fall sweepstakes is easy, but you can't win if you don't enter. To enter, simply mail back your reply card to KABU so that we receive it before 5 p.m. local time on Friday, October 13th. We'll announce the winner on air Saturday, October 14th at noon. If you're a KABU member and haven't received your sweepstakes entry form yet, please contact KABU's membership department at 503-231-8032, extension 207, or send an email to membership@kabu.org.
This is called Hello, a Dream. It's about, I composed that actually when I called my family when I was in Syria. And I asked my niece and nephew about what they are dreaming right now. During this.
Welcome to another KABU Public Affairs special focus on the crisis in Gaza. I'm William Seaman, and co-hosting today's special program, it's my great pleasure to once again be sharing the studio with Hala Goris. Hala, good to see you again.
Good morning, Will. Good morning to our listeners.
I'd like our listeners to know that a little later in the program, we are going to be taking calls. So if you have a question for one of our guests, or for Hala and myself, please consider calling KABU at 503-231-8187, and of course we'll be giving that number again. We're very fortunate to have with us by telephone two very special guests this morning. In about 30 minutes, we'll be speaking with Israeli historian Elan Pape. But first, Hala is going to introduce our first guest for this morning.
Thank you, Will. Before I introduce our first guest, I would like to tell our listeners they can provide us feedback by emailing us at pdx@riseup.net.
Actually, that's pdxjustice@riseup.net. We have a little typo in our notes.
Sorry about that. Joining us from Ramallah in the West Bank is Diana Botu. Ms. Botu is a Palestinian-Canadian lawyer born to Palestinian parents. She received a law degree from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and a PhD from Stanford University. Ms. Buttu is a legal advisor and spokesperson with the Palestine Liberation Organization. She advises on peace negotiations with Israel and on refugee issues. In 2000, she left North America to move to Palestine in order to assist with the then peace negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel as one of the PLO's legal advisors. With the outbreak of the second Palestinian uprising, the Intifada, against Israel's occupation, and the breakdown of negotiations, Deanna decided to remain in Palestine. She gained prominence during Israel's invasion of the West Bank, serving as spokesperson for the PLO. Ms. Buttu assisted in the litigation against Israel's apartheid wall at The Hague in 2004, a resounding victory for the Palestinians and an indictment of Israel's wall. In 2005, she was appointed President Abbas's communications director. She has since left her official post. She now resides in Palestine, where she's writing a book on the Israeli occupation. Prior to moving to Palestine in 2000, Ms. Buttu also served as legal counsel to the Canadian Department of Justice. Good morning, Ms. Buttu.
Good morning.
And it's actually evening your time, isn't it?
It is. It's evening my time. It's it's about 6 o'clock in the evening my time.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can you please give our listeners some idea of the size of the Gaza Strip and how densely populated it is?
The Gaza Strip, which is a place that I actually lived for a period of about a year, is the most densely populated place on Earth. It's about 26 miles long and 12 miles wide at its widest point, with about 1.3 million people living in the Gaza Strip, many of whom are refugees who have been denied the ability to return to their homes in what is now Israel, because of the fact that they are not, because of the fact that they're not Jewish, they're Christians and Muslims, and so they live in refugee camps, unable to return to their homes inside Israel. Apart from being the most densely populated place on Earth, the Gaza Strip is an area that that is completely controlled on all sides, whether it's the airspace that's controlled by Israel, the sea coast is controlled by Israel, or even the border between Israel and the Gaza Strip is controlled by Israel, or the border crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. So every single aspect of the Gaza Strip itself is actually controlled by Israel. So it's a tiny strip of land, very densely populated, but despite the dense population, the Palestinians remain under Israeli military control, unable to move or to do anything without getting Israeli permission.
But, Deanna, many in Israel and the West talk about the disengagement that Israel basically stopped occupying the Gaza Strip. Is that accurate?
The Israelis, there were two things that were happening from 1967 up until the year 2005 in the Gaza Strip. And there are two processes that I think people often confuse. The first was there was a colonization process. And what that meant was that the Israeli government was actually taking Palestinian land in the Gaza Strip and using it to build settlements, colonies, for Israelis only. These colonies are about, there were roughly 21 of them at the time. They had an estimated 8,000 Israelis. But these 8,000 Israelis living in the Gaza Strip at the time had more rights than the remaining 1.3 million Palestinians who were residing there. They had better water consumption. They were allowed to travel wherever they wanted to. They didn't need Israeli permission for anything. And on top of that, the 8,000 Israelis controlled approximately 30% of the land. Now, that colonization process came to an end last year in 2005 when the Israeli government dismantled the settlements, the colonies in the Gaza Strip, and evacuated the settlers. There was another process, however, that was taking place at that same time between 1967 and that continues till today, and that is the occupation, the military control over the Gaza Strip. So, but that, unfortunately, that aspect of Israel's activity has not come to an end. And what I mean by that is that everything from controlling the movement of people to the movement of goods to whether people are allowed to work inside Israel or not work inside Israel. Almost every single aspect of Palestinian life is actually controlled by Israel and remains under Israeli control. So while last year the colonization of the Gaza Strip came to a close, the actual occupation of it and control over it still continues to this day. So I think that's why there's a great deal of confusion.
Thank you for clarifying that. Can you tell us about the recent events starting in May, June of this year, please?
Sorry, about the recent events?
Starting with, I think in the West they talk about all of this starting with the abduction of Gilad Shalit. But things had started earlier than that in terms of the Israeli attack on Gaza and Gazans.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. What we now are reading about in Gaza, and I think not so many of us are actually seeing anything about it, is something that has been continuing for a long period of time. This didn't just start with the capture of an Israeli soldier, but has actually gone on for almost 39 years, but most specifically over the course of the past year. And what has happened over the course of the past year is that after the Israelis evacuated the settlements of the Gaza Strip, they basically locked down the Gaza Strip and threw away the key and tightened the screws on the Gaza Strip. So everything from military raids over the space of Gaza and bombing of Palestinian homes, continued assassinations of Palestinians, using the seawaters to actually attack Palestinians who were sitting on the beach, and we saw very dramatically the attack and killing of one young girl's family as she was sitting there on the beach herself. All of these activities have been things that have continued ever since last year, but then I think people seem to forget and instead are now focusing on the actual capture of the Israeli soldier and saying that that is what has precipitated these events, but when in fact it has not. This is something that has been continuing now for years and years and years, but most specifically over the course of the past year. Unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot of media coverage of the issue.
Well, that brings me to another issue on the media coverage. Why is it that in the West we hear very little about what is happening in Gaza and the West Bank?
There's a few reasons, actually. It's a really good question, and there's a few reasons that we don't hear so much about what's happening in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank as compared to when something happens inside Israel. The first reason is that the Gaza Strip and West Bank are areas that are very, very, very difficult to get to and very difficult to move around in. So, for example, to get to the Gaza Strip, you actually need Israeli permission to enter into the Gaza Strip. So I, even as a Canadian, need Israeli permission to go into the Gaza Strip, and that permission is granted by the Israeli army. If they do not want me to go in, which has been the case now for several months, then I cannot go in. Similarly, when it comes to media coverage, actually getting into the Gaza Strip in a lot of cases is very difficult. Journalists are quite hesitant to go down there. It takes a lot to go down there. And then on your way out, you're always subject to incredible security searches as one is leaving the Gaza Strip. Everything from using an entire X-ray machine to scan, to do a full body scan, to actually denying certain goods the ability to leave the Gaza Strip. So it becomes a very arduous process for people to get in and out of the Gaza Strip. In the West Bank, the situation is slightly different. While you don't need a permit to enter into the West Bank, the West Bank is riddled with checkpoints, such that to get into any Palestinian city, you have to cross a number of checkpoints into that city. So for journalists who are on a tight deadline, they can't really take the unpredictability of the checkpoints, and so a lot of times they simply just don't come to the places in the West Bank. Another major reason is also a structural reason, which is that of of censorship. While the Israeli government claims that it doesn't officially censor the articles of journalists, it does a sort of thing of trying to, for example, deny entry for certain journalists if they don't like the coverage, to also not renewing the visas of certain journalists if they don't like the coverage. For example, the BBC, there was a BBC reporter who for many, many years, the Israeli government was saying that they did not want her to return because they didn't like her coverage. And in the end, at one point denied entry into the BBC bureau chief as a means of sending a message to the BBC that they were not happy with the BBC's coverage. So that's yet another reason. But beyond that, I think that there's an even bigger reason that the issue of what's going on in the West Bank and Gaza is not covered. And I think that it's just become very commonplace on the part of journalists. Whereas journalists actually live in Israel, they associate with Israelis, they understand what's going on in Israel. Very few journalists actually live in the West Bank or on the Gaza Strip. And in fact, in the West Bank, there's only one foreign journalist who lives in the West Bank, and she happens to be an Israeli. Her name is Amira Haas. Apart from that, the journalists don't actually live in the area, and so when they don't live in the area, it becomes very easy for them to just dismiss the killings, dismiss the reports of injuries, and dismiss everything that's happening because they actually don't have any connection to the Palestinians who are living in these areas. So there's a number of reasons. I won't get into the editorial issue, but those are just some of the basic reasons why things have not been covered in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
Ms. Buttu, this is Will Seaman. I want to remind our listeners that we are taking calls, so if you have a question for our guest today, you can dial 503-231-8187. Ms. Buttu, I was wondering if you could comment on reports that have been coming out of Gaza. UN representatives, human rights representatives, B'Tselem just published a report describing the attack on the power station in Gaza as a war crime, having looked into this, investigated the character of the attack and the justification that was provided by the Israeli military. But I wonder if you could talk about the quite astonishing increase in casualties in Gaza, the deaths among people living in Gaza, many of them children, certainly many of them civilians. Could you talk about how there seems to have been this change in the degree of violence that is that the people there are experiencing?
Yes, definitely. The Israeli attack on the Palestinian transformer, which is the only power station in the Gaza city, they actually hit the transformer, not just the power station itself, what actually turns out the electricity. Now, the attack on that has ended up impacting almost the entire Gaza Strip with rampant power shortages now taking place. On average, I'm told now, I haven't been down to the Gaza Strip in a while because I cannot get in, but I'm told that there's been power shortages that are rampant, with power only being supplied to Palestinians between 4 to 6 hours on a daily basis. Now, what this means when there's no power being supplied is that it also affects everything from whether you can keep food in the fridge. And this has been a summer that has been particularly hot, so people haven't been able to keep any food in their fridge and anything in their freezer because it all goes bad, to other basic things like being able to pump water. Because the Gaza Strip is such a densely populated place, the vast majority of Palestinians live in high-rise houses, and high-rise houses need electricity to pump the water so that people actually get water provided to their apartments. With the rampant water shortages, water has been in very short supply, and a lot of the water that is coming in is quite brackish. So on top of suffering the lack of electricity, which we've all grown very accustomed to, it's become pretty much a right rather than a luxury, they're also suffering from not having very clean water, from having brackish water. So that's some of the other things that are happening. It also impacts everything from the ability of people while they're in the hospital, to get proper medical treatment. A lot of the machinery requires, obviously, electricity, to other things, such as being able having to fund generators, which is obviously a very costly venture, particularly given that 165,000 employees of the Palestinian Authority haven't been receiving their salaries for almost 7 months now. So life in Gaza has become incredibly difficult. But I think one of the most interesting things is that normally when you have a situation of war, whether the war is taking place in Serbia, Bosnia, in any other, almost any other context, there's usually a war that takes place on one level, but civilian life actually continues on another level. But in the case of the Palestinians, and in particular the Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, you have a war that's actually taking place against the civilian population, so that civilian life is not actually proceeding as normal. It's become an abnormal existence. So this is unlike the case of other situations of war, where one would go and yes, there'd be war and fighting and so on and so forth, but you would see continuation of civilian life. This is not necessarily the case when it comes to Palestinians living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because the attacks have taken place against civilians themselves, which is why I believe the UN has been decrying all many of these actions and has come out very strongly against Israel's destruction of the power transformer in the Gaza Strip.
Deanna, this collective punishment against the Palestinians is against international law and against humanitarian law. What do you think the Israeli government hopes to achieve by collapsing the infrastructure in Gaza, by making the sewage system so unhealthy that disease could break out, by starving the population, etc.? What do you think the Israeli government hopes to accomplish?
You know, that's a really good question, and it's a very difficult question also to answer, because in many cases, I'm not so sure that the Israeli government knows why it's doing it itself, other than to say that it can. Sometimes I think in a lot of ways that it's designed to actually break the will of the Palestinian people, to try to get the Palestinians to turn against one another, so that they will look at Israel as being their savior and you know, look towards other factions as being the cause of their demise. But I think in some cases it's simply a question of Israel can do it. Nobody's Israel from doing it, and because nobody's stopping Israel from doing it, they continue to do it. So that's a lot of the, I think, the actions that have taken place inside Israel. So in many cases, I think that they're trying to do it as a means. They don't view it as collective punishment. They view it as individualized punishment, and it's mostly for them a means of trying to get extremist actions to stop, and I think that they hope that this will turn the population against itself. But a lot of times I think it is that they just haven't been given the slap on the wrist that they should be given by the international community. And so when Israel goes so far as demolishing people's homes while people are actually in the house, to assassinating Palestinians, including we see now there's been 200 Palestinians who've been assassinated or been killed as a result of an assassination, that when there's no condemnation on the part of the international community, and we've certainly seen the lack of condemnation, that Israel just continues to proceed as though this is something normal.
What can Americans do to convince the U.S. administration to stop funding the terror in Gaza by the Israelis?
I think there's a few things that can be done, and that I think there's a few things that should be done. One of the interesting provisions in U.S. law states that the United States cannot provide armory or artillery to an army if that artillery is going to be used against a civilian population. And you know, there's supposed to be an accounting of when that artillery is used against a civilian population. Now in the case of Israel, excuse me, they've used everything from F-16s to some of the actual physical weaponry to the tanks against the civilian population, and yet there has been absolutely no accounting against the Israeli government for this. So I think there's something as simple as trying to even get your representatives of Congress to start raising these questions in Congress. Why is it that Israel is considered to be a nation above all nations when it comes to U.S. military assistance in the form of actual weaponry? Beyond the issue of weaponry, excuse me, there's other means that I think that can be done, which is by simply showing that right now, what Israel is not serving as an ally to the United States, and in fact, it's the U.S.'s relationship with Israel that has been the cause of much of the friction and much of the tension in the Middle East. And you hear this from, whether it's from mild governments all the way up down to the street level to other organizations who are basically saying, we don't hate America, we don't hate Americans, but we certainly loathe American foreign policy and American double standards when it comes to this issue. And I think that simply trying to highlight this issue to representatives of Congress and to the government is something that can and should be done. And I hope that it would certainly have some effect.
And our guest today is Diana Bhutu, who is a spokesperson for the Palestine Liberation Organization and very active in the struggle for self-determination and human rights in the West Bank and Gaza. Our call-in number here is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. If you have a question for our guest, we only have about 4 more minutes here with Diana. I wonder, Diana, if you could talk a little bit perhaps more concretely of the experience of people on the ground in Gaza. You've mentioned the impact, sort of in the abstract, in terms of the difficulty of pumping water in high-rise apartments, or the difficulty of refrigerating foods, and we should also mention medicines as well, with the destruction of the transformer in Gaza. But what is life like? Can you give us some examples of specific people, their experience in Gaza today?
There's many, many, many examples, and I wish we had more than 4 minutes, because there are enough examples to fill a lifetime of stories. I'll try to share very briefly two stories of my friends. One of my friends is an ice cream producer, and he's a man who was actually trained, educated in the United States, and moved back to the Gaza Strip because he really wanted to do something in the Gaza Strip, help the people of the Gaza Strip, which is where he's from, and opened up and very successfully managed an ice cream company that was based in the Gaza Strip, but that also shipped out ice cream to Israel and to the West Bank, as well as maintaining production within the Gaza Strip alone. His purpose in setting up the operation inside the Gaza Strip was because he really wanted to employ people in the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip has an unemployment rate of roughly 60%, which is an incredibly high rate. So his thinking was he would open up this factory in the Gaza Strip. Unfortunately, given the fact that there's no power, given the fact that people cannot maintain any food, the last thing that they're thinking of keeping in their refrigerators is something like ice cream. And so here is a young entrepreneur, somebody that I'm sure everybody knows or has contact to, somebody like him, who has as a result gone bankrupt as a result of what life is like now in Gaza. There's other stories of people, including a family that I met, a man who hasn't received a salary now because he's a Palestinian Authority employee for almost 7 months, who put an ad into a newspaper to try to sell one of his kidneys so that he would be able to get money in order to feed his children. He lives in a very, very modest home. His children, at the time that I saw them, were dining off of sour cream and a small loaf of bread.
Deanna, that
is. Unfortunately, this is what life is like now for many of the Palestinian Authority mm-hmm. employees who have no economic means.
Deanna, that is terribly sad. We understand the people in Gaza have reached the level of starving. Thank you for joining us from Ramallah and sharing the grave humanitarian crisis from where you are today.
Thank you very much, Helen. Thank you, Will.
Thank you.
And thank you, Diana, and thank you, Hala. We hope to check back in. We hope that you, Diana, will check back in with us in the coming months. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. Now, if you'd like to hear and see more of our guest, Diana Buttu, on these topics, you can check the website www.pdxjustice.org. That's pdxjustice.org, where you can find streaming video of her lecture from last April, the lecture titled From Occupation to Enclosure, Fragmenting the Palestinian State. This was Ms. Buttu's presentation at the Rachel Corrie Peaceworks Conference up in Olympia last April. And you can also check out our recent interviews with Noam Chomsky, Ali Abu Nima, and others. We're going to take a very, very brief musical break, and then we're going to be back speaking with Israeli historian Ilan Pape, author of The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1948 to 1951, and more recently, A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples. We're back. I'm William Seaman with Hala Goris, and on the phone with us from his home in Haifa, northern Israel, is Israeli historian Ilan Pape. He is author of The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1948 to 1951. More recently, A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, and The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Earlier this month, he published an essay, Genocide in Gaza, at the website Electronic Intifada. Ilan, thank you for joining us this morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and I hope I can hear a bit better as the interview continues.
Okay, we'll try to speak up.
That's better.
Hopefully, okay. We'll have some calls as well, and I hope very much that you'll be able to hear some call-ins today. Now, let's start with this essay from earlier this month. Ilan, the word genocide is certainly a politically loaded term, evoking the mass killings of Darfur, Rwanda, Cambodia, and of course for a Jewish audience, the Holocaust. And it's clear from this essay you did not choose that word casually. What are your perceptions of the latest crisis in Gaza that led you to describing Israeli policies there as constituting genocide?
Yes, indeed. I was very hesitant before using the term for all the reasons that you have mentioned. But it's very difficult to describe Israeli policies all in all, not just when it comes to massive killings, also when it comes lately to uprooting and transferring people, because they are maintained for such a long period of time that actually it's their accumulative outcome that we refer to, rather than to what they've been doing for 1 week or 2 weeks, which is usually the historical cases you refer to, or even for 4 years. So I think this was first an overview of 6 years and trends which show escalation in the Israeli policies towards the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The second reason why I chose this term was because I realized that the Israelis are lost. They have no idea what to do with the Gaza Strip. Whereas they think, and that may also be a mistake, but at least they think that because the West Bank has a border with Jordan, some sort of a solution would be found by which they can push out Palestinians towards areas which would be adjacent to Jordan and somehow get rid of these people that, from their point of view, are a problem. But they have no such ideas of how to deal with the Gaza Strip. They took out the settlers. They imprisoned the Gaza people within a huge prison camp. Lately, the United Nations admitted that this is the case in Gaza. And yet the inmates, if you want, in the prison continue to resist the impossible conditions imposed on them. And the Israelis are thinking, what can they do next? And in the meantime, they bombard the most dense area in the world with F-16s, shell them with cannons, with cannons from the sea as well, with the Navy ships. The daily reap is several people, quite often children, killed inside the Gaza Strip. And from what everyone hears from the Israeli policymakers, this is going to continue and escalate.
I want to mention to our callers again that if they'd like to ask our guest any questions, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. We'd love to hear from you. Ilan Pape is our guest, Israeli historian. Ilan, now during the recent Lebanon war, I thought this was interesting that you mentioned this in your essay. There were reports of Israeli pilots refusing to execute attacks on targets that they believed were attacks that they believed were likely to kill civilians. And in your article, you mentioned something called the Lebanon procedure. Could you explain that and tell us whether you think this is common practice and whether it reflects Israeli policy?
Yes, indeed. I mentioned that in the first Lebanon War in 1982, there was something which would later was called the Lebanon procedure. The Israeli pilots in 1982 were instructed to abort a mission if they found out that the targets that they were sent to bomb were not the ones that they thought they were. Namely, if a military target was proved to be a civilian target, they were to abort mission and return back. And they also defined a parameter of a radius of 500 meters as an area in which if civilians are within this radius, even if there are military targets in it, the mission should be aborted. Now, in the second Lebanon War, the pilots asked whether this procedure is still intact, and they were told not anymore. But this was not the first time that they inquired whether the procedure was intact. A few weeks before the second Lebanon War started, the Israeli pilots started bombarding systematically the Gaza Strip, and they asked a similar question, and the answer was again in the negative, that in the densely, one of the probably the most dense area in the world, there is no point in appropriating this procedure, namely bomb massively, regardless of how many civilians there are and how many civilian casualties would be the outcome of such attacks.
Professor Pape, good morning. This is Hala Goris.
Good morning.
I have a question for you about Israeli society in general in terms of what is happening in Gaza. Is it widely known that Gazans are being suffocated, starved, and bombed?
Well, let me put it this way. Most Israelis do not want to know. It's very easy to know. Most of them do not want to know. The Israeli media, almost all of it, mainstream and what supposedly is more critical, collaborate in this denial. There are hardly any reports. And the reports which they are being sidelined to a very marginal place in the newspaper or the news bulletin on the radio or in television. But on the other hand, given the internet revolution that we have, of course, every Israeli can know exactly what happens, but they choose not to know. So I think that's the situation, which I think the term denial is an apt term for describing such an attitude towards the reality around us.
You know, for those in denial, they must know there is something to be in denial about. So I'm trying to understand how it is that those in Israel are not absolutely up in arms about what the Air Force is doing, what the military is doing in Gaza, as well as the West Bank.
Well, in order to understand it, one has to go back to what I call the ideological infrastructure of the state, which is transmitted to people, to the citizens, through the educational system, the cultural media, the media itself. Yeah? And there you can see very easily. Hello?
Are you still there? We can still hear
yes,
you.
Yes, I'm still there. Are you there?
Yes, we're here. Can you hear us?
Yeah, we're there. Okay, I'll continue. So,
Thank you.
Through the educational system, the main message that an citizen of Israel receives is that is a dehumanization of the Palestinians, to make it short. A dehumanization. In other words, I'm not sure that even if people would know the extent and the scope of the killing and the bombardment from the air, people would feel any remorse or any problem with that. We saw it in the Lebanon war. Some of the worst, some of the main criticism directed against the Israeli army was that it did not flatten the Palestinian villager, that it was not killing enough Palestinians. This was the main criticism, not the actual killing, Lebanese citizens, not the actual bombardment of Lebanese villages, but the very, what they thought was a limited scope of bombardment.
What in terms of opposing views, that is, we can talk broadly about the peace movement, but there are certainly, that in itself is a fairly vague sort of politics in Israel, but surely there's some part of the population, as there is in the United States in terms of resistance to the U.S. war and occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan, that are active in opposing these kinds of policies.
Well, I think it's a negligent opposition movement. I think it's important that it exists. I think it allows people like myself to have a framework for acting against the occupation. But if one wants to remain realistic and assess the chances of such an opposition from within, one should boldly and courageously say that they have very little chance in changing opinions or in changing, the policies themselves. I think the importance of these opposing groups is for building a better future in the long term, but they are very negligent as far as changing the current Israeli policies or the Israeli policies in the near future. For that, you need a very strong pressure from the outside. For that, you need to adopt the South African model. You need to turn the state into a pariah state as long as these policies continue. That's the only way of stopping the killings in Gaza.
Yeah, and that's certainly a nice segue into the conclusion of your essay, where you essentially call for international pressure on Israel. I was when I was in Gaza a few years ago, I was very fortunate to interview Dr. Haider Abdel Shafi, and he pointed out that an earlier occupation of Gaza, in the case of a much earlier occupation, the U.S. snapped its fingers and Israel withdrew within 24 hours. What's your perception of the U.S. role in all of this? We can talk about the international community, but the main paymaster is the United States, and that's through Democratic and Republican administrations alike. Do you see, in terms of that support, has that also influenced the political landscape in Israel today?
Yes, I'll put it crudely. Without the United States support, these policies would have been impossible. Without the United States support, Israel would have not been able to do what it did in Lebanon. And without that support, Israel could not have continued an occupation, which is a very costly business. So the U.S. role is crucial and in fact, conditional for the success of these policies. So I think it's there shouldn't be any doubt of it. And as pointed by Haider Abdel Shafi, the U.S. has the potential of playing a very different role in bringing about a change in these policies. But ever since 9/11, and probably before 9/11, various movements in the United States, like the Christian Zionists, the neoconservatives, and the pro-Zionist lobby, AIPAC, were pushing, one should say successfully, towards the policies that gives Israel a blank check for pursuing these policies. Israel can do these policies knowing that it has the American umbrella, not only in terms of getting military aid and financial support, but also being immune from any international criticism and pressure.
Professor Pape, in terms of international pressure, are you talking about boycotting and divestment?
Yes, I think a variety of means should be examined. I don't think we have found yet the way to do it. This is certainly a much more complex case study than the case study of South Africa. But I would say that even the beginnings I have seen of what I call moral sanctions, namely that these were not actual sanctions, but they were a threat to sanction Israel, have really had an impact here. People are here want people here want very much to be considered to be part of the Western world, what they call the civilized world. And if this world sends a message that there is a price tag attached to these policies, even in terms of considering any Israeli request to be part of an international organization for receiving international aid, for concluding bilateral agreements and so on every level, not just the state level, but on academic level or any other institutional level. I think these kinds of actions send a very powerful message to the Israelis that very important people in the world, in their eyes, do not condone what they do and in fact condemn it and are willing to pressure them to change it. This hasn't happened as yet. So we are trying to organize it, because I really think this is the only way of salvaging not only the Palestinians from future destruction, but also the Israelis themselves from what will happen once they have implemented their policies against the Palestinians before.
Can you tell us how you are trying to organize this boycott or divestment program?
Well, I cannot organize it myself. I mean, I'm here. I can only give moral support to those who organize. So I think it's very interesting. I think it started by the civil society in the occupied territories calling a few years ago for the outside world to help them to end a 40 years occupation and future plans of destroying them. And the call was very powerful, very well articulated, and many, many part of the Palestinian civil society under occupation took part in this call. This was taken by all kinds of groups around the world who support that call. And in a certain stage, these people approached people like myself, saying that it is important to have also a moral voice from within the Jewish state, saying that we accept this as the only way forward, because the armed struggle is not, the Palestinian armed struggle is self-destructive, didn't lead to anywhere, and the peace process has failed. And at that stage, I, and not only myself, few others, we joined in and we said that morally we accept it, and realistically, by analyzing it, we see it as the only way forward, although I must tell you I'm not that optimistic. I'm not sure that even this would be enough to change the dismal situation on the ground.
And I want to mention once again to our listeners that if you have a question for our guest, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187 is the call-in number here at KABU. Our guest is Ilan Pape, Israeli historian. He is author of The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1948 to 1951, and more recently, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this more recent book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. I must say that using the word genocide in terms of describing what is happening in Gaza, the use of this phrase, ethnic cleansing, as well, is going to raise some hackles for people in terms of their perceptions.
First of all, I'm not the first one to use it. In fact, some historians used it before me, some Palestinian historians, and even an Israeli historian who supports the actions of 1948 called it an ethnic cleansing. This is my colleague Benny Morris. Both of us were once termed as the new historians of Israel. So I think this is a much more acceptable term to academics, at least, who look at the policy of uprooting people in 1948. What I do in the book, I try and show that this is a paradigm of thought that fed the Israeli actions in 1948, but also feeds the Israeli actions ever since 1948. I think the basic idea is that Jewish welfare and well-being in Palestine cannot be secured as long as there are Palestinians on the ground. And the big debate inside Israel is, of course, of how to achieve it. But nobody argues against the logic of this assumption. And I'm trying to show how in 1948 and after 1948, this paradigm, this ideological framework conceived from that ideological framework, the policies of 1948 and after 1948 were conceived and formulated. So this was the fountain, if you want, the ideological fountain from which most Israeli policymakers drink, and which can explain many of the Israeli actions, including the one we talked about before, the current Israeli policies towards the Gaza Strip.
And we actually have a caller with a question on this topic. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. My question is whether Zionism is strictly a political movement or whether it is also a religious movement, and whether there is confusion about what Zionism actually is and what the implications might be. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your question. It's a good one. do I have an hour?
10 minutes.
I'll try and make it short. I think that, first of all, it's a political movement. It's an ideological movement. However, it's an ideological movement that tried to politicize a religion. In fact, this is the best way of putting it. It took a very wealthy and rich religious heritage of Judaism that moved people outside of Zionism to amazing acts of bravery and moral courage against discrimination, oppression, wherever they found it, and turned that very rich legacy into a very narrow one, which created the basis for how to secure the group of people who settled in Palestine in 1882 and thereafter. So I think religion is being exploited here in order to justify the actual colonization of Palestine in 1882 and then to justify the policies against the native population of Palestine, the Palestinians, and I think we're still in a project in the making, which has not as yet ended.
Professor Poppy, we have one more caller. Caller, you're on.
Professor, how does one contend with the powerful Jewish lobby here in the United States? It's so difficult. Anyone that opposes the policies of Israel is immediately called anti-Semitic, and they're ostracized. They don't get on the air. They don't get on the radio. How would you suggest we confront this lobby that has taken hold of American policy?
Yeah, thank you for your question. First of all, I think you're right. It's a very powerful disincentive for people to come forward, even if they think that the Israeli policies are wrong and if they think that the American support for these policies are wrong. So I think it's a very good question. I would also point out that it's not only the lobby. I mean, there is also the problem of the Christian Zionists, which is a powerful movement outside the lobby, which also influences American policy. But as far as the lobby is concerned, I think that one of the best ways of confronting it is to warn that since American policy is going from wrong to from bad to worse, and the Iraqi quagmire is a very good example, the fact that the lobby has associated so much these policies with the safety of Israel by itself can create a resurgence of anti-Semitism, because people would say America has failed dramatically. And why had it failed? Because it was trying to satisfy the interests of a proxy and not the American national security. Secondly, I think there are alternative voices in the Jewish community in the United States. They have to be organized. They have to speak in the name of Judaism against this abuse of the Holocaust memory, against this abuse of Jewish values. It shouldn't be left just to to people who are Palestinians or are supporters of the Palestinian cause. And I think Israelis like myself can add their voice. I can tell you from my own experience in tours in the United States that the AIPAC people disappear into thin air when I speak, because they have very little to say to me, and I can hardly be accused of anti-Semitism. And the last point I will make, I think they've overdone the anti-Semitic card. It's going to wane. It's going to peter out. I don't think it works anymore, and I think people should not be deterred by it and shouldn't be afraid by it, and then we can face it, confront it, and push for a much better and more productive American policy.
Professor, thank you for talking to us about what the Jewish community can do on this issue. For our listeners, if you go to www.jewishvoiceforpeace.org, great organization and terrific resource. Also, Chicago's chapter of the Jewish Voice for Peace has a great website. It's www.notinmyname, but actually it's www.nimn.org.
And there's certainly locally Jewish organizations that are weighing in on these issues and across the country, more and more of these organizations. But, of course, not just Jewish organizations. There's also the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, which you can find at endtheoccupation.org. In terms of your perceptions of organizing around these issues, I mean, in the last 5 years, we've had the emergence of the International Solidarity Organization, people on the ground in the occupied territories doing this work in solidarity with Palestinians. We've seen the emergence of these anti-occupation organizations here in the United States. What's your perception from within Israel in terms of an increase in activism? Do you think it's significant what's happening? I know I also wanted to mention there was a caller, or there was this question about the divestment campaign, and there is the Caterpillar campaign in particular. This is a campaign targeting the Caterpillar Corporation, which provides these giant, I think they're called D9 armored bulldozers that are used not just to destroy housing, but they're essentially used as a weapon in the occupation.
Yes, indeed. I think that, you know, judging from the way that the campaign developed in the case of South Africa, where there were also ups and downs, and it took longer than people remember to get the campaign going, we are, unfortunately, only in the beginning of the campaign. I say unfortunately because I'm not sure we have the same amount of time that the people in South Africa had. It took about 21 years in South Africa to establish a meaningful and an effective anti-apartheid movement that worked in solidarity with the ANC. We don't even have a proper ANC. That's another problem. But I think that definitely with each passing month and year, another center of activity emerges in the United States or in Europe or elsewhere that shows that people just had enough. They watch on TV or they visit themselves, as you mentioned, the ISM, and see for themselves what's going on, and they feel that they want to help the people on the ground to stop it. And the thing is, we still need a coordinating hand. We still need a much more expanded activity, but it is growing. In fact, it's inevitable. It's inevitable after 40 years of occupation for a place which is so much at the center of attention that this would happen. The big question is which pace is going to win? The slow, now for the time being, the slow pace of creating such a powerful civil society movement to change things on the ground, or the very presently quick pace of destruction of the Israeli will to change the realities on the ground, because they feel that they have a window of opportunity with the unequivocal American support to create irreversible facts that would make any future attempts to change it impossible.
And on that note, we're going to have to bring an end to this segment with our guest, Israeli historian Ilan Pappe. Ilan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we have a number of announcements we'd like to talk about. As Ilan Pappe pointed out, there's this question of what is going to happen, how are things going to unfold there, and we face a choice very much up to us, and I'd like to talk about some, Hala's going to talk about some events here locally you can get involved with.
Portland's a great place to be this afternoon at Pioneer Square, Southwest Broadway and Yamhill, between 3 to 7 p.m., is the Indian Day celebration, in celebration of American Indian culture and our Northwest tribes. There will be drumming groups, dancers, art vendors. Show them your support and go down to Pioneer Square.
I want to mention the music that you're going to hear in a moment. The music that introduced this program is by Rahim Al-Haj. He's a wonderful musician. He plays the oud. And he's going to be in Portland on Saturday, October 28th, 7 p.m. at the First Congregational Church. That's a part of a weekend of events. Jamming for Peace is the musical program, but it's part of a weekend of events focused on the situation in Iran and the possibility of the United States attacking Iran. And that is, again, Saturday, October 28th.
And one last announcement, October 4th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at PSU, Mercy Corps will be speaking about the update from Lebanon and Gaza, the humanitarian crises.
And you have been listening to a special KABU Public Affairs program, Focus on the Crisis in Gaza. I'm William Seaman, and with me today, Hala Gores. Thank you very much for listening, and support. Continue your support of KABU Community Grassroots Democratic Media. Listening to KBOL Portland, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. It's 1 minute after 10 o'clock. I'm Barbara Bernstein, and we're going to be spending the next half hour listening to a special program of features that were produced for a project KBOL has been running for the last couple of years called the Whole Communities Radio Project. About 2 years ago, we got a grant from Sound Partners for Community Health, which is sponsored was sponsored by money from Robert Woods Johnson Foundation, to do a series of programming and community events called the Whole Communities Radio Project, which looked at the connections between urban design and community health. And part of the project, which involved, among other things, monthly panel discussions on a series of topics that we had on Locus Focus each Wednesday morning, a series of community events sponsored by our partner in the project, the Coalition for a Livable Future. We also did an extensive training program here at KABU and trained a number of news and public affairs volunteers to become really good producers of features. And some of them have gone on and produced features for national programs. And we're very pleased. In fact, the first person that we're going to be hearing from, Miriam Whitman, just had a piece on All Things Considered a few nights ago. So it's really exciting to see this training program blossom and people really go on and become serious radio producers. So we're going to be listening to four of the features that were produced over the over the course of the last year and a half, and we'll just listen to them straight through until 10:30. And first we're going to hear a piece that Miriam Whitman did about the Walmart that wasn't in Cedar Mill, and she did this piece in April of 2005, and subsequently the Beaverton City Council about a month and a half ago voted to deny the permit for this Walmart, and so the Walmart is not happening in Cedar Mill. Then we'll be hearing a piece by Julie Sabatier about the gentrification of Alberta Street, and as far as I know, Alberta Street continues to be gentrified since this piece was produced. We'll hear a piece by Eduardo de Landeras Tierra about a place in North Portland called Plaza Town. His piece is called The Legacy of Plaza Town. It's about environmental justice issues and looking at the kinds of toxic problems, environmental toxins that people who live in low-income neighborhoods, particularly in housing projects like this, have to deal with. And most of the people that live in this housing project, in fact, are refugees from Africa. Finally, we're going to hear a piece called Water Piece by Kayleen Chassie, which looks at the 300-plus miles of culverted, disappeared streams and creeks in the Portland area. So we'll start out with Miriam Whitman's piece and go all the way through to Kayleen's piece in the next half hour.
This is the intersection of Barnes Road and Cedar Hills Boulevard, about 10 miles west of Portland. The site Walmart is thinking about is across from a shopping development that includes an Albertsons, a Hollywood video store, and an Outback Steakhouse. The Max line is about a half mile away, a tough trek if you're carrying groceries or stuff from Walmart. The Cedar Mill neighborhood is to the north. That's where Mike Burton, the former director of the regional authority Metro, lives. He says while many residents may not like Walmart for its corporate practices, that's not the issue.
My concern is traffic. My concern is the integrity of the neighborhood. My concern is safety. My concern is neighborhood livability.
The anti-Walmart group has organized under the banner Save Cedar Mill. Steve Kaufman chairs the group. It's against a Walmart on the corner of Cedar Hills and Barnes because of its expected regional draw.
If you do put a Fred Meyer or a Target on that site, you're not going to get somebody who lives in Woodburn or 82nd or anywhere else that this will pull from the west side and the immediate east side driving all the way out to our Fred Meyer. There's one already there.
Community activists may be an odd role for Kaufman. He graduated from Stanford with a degree in urban planning, but that was years ago. Today, he's an IT executive and works near the Walmart site. He's never been an activist before. So why is he chairman of Safe Cedar Mill?
I'm involved because I believe our land use planning process is flawed. I'm angry that voices got squashed that need to be heard. And like a lot of people who are involved in Safe Cedar Mill, I finally said, you know, enough is enough. This is just wrong. There's no citizen input in the process to have made this sort of selection. The zoning is badly outdated to the existing flavor of the neighborhood. It's not the kind of development anybody wants in the immediate neighborhood. And we're not going to get steamrolled.
The area state senator, Charlie Ringo, agrees.
To me, the issue is community involvement. I don't really want to say Walmart is good or bad, or whether it's a Target or an IKEA or Fred Meyer's, but it's going in your neighborhood. And you ought to have a say about how your neighborhood grows. That's my issue.
That, Ringo and others say, is part of the problem with this development. The city of Beaverton annexed the property just before Walmart announced its interest. The land zoning decision was made when Washington County revamped zoning for the area in the mid-90s. State Senator Charlie Ringo.
Now, people will say that, gee, 2 years ago, 4 years ago, whenever it was that they zoned that land big box, that was your chance to object. That's when you should have stood up and said, no, we're going to object to this because someday a Walmart might come. You know, theoretically that's true, but it ignores the way people really live their lives, and it sets up a situation where they dump it on you and you don't have any choice.
Washington County officials don't agree. Ann Madden is a senior official with the county's Department of Land Use and Transportation. She says the county and the state can have a say on traffic impacts.
Actually, I think this is one of the ways that the county will be able to weigh in on this application, and that does have to do with the traffic impacts, because they are county roads, and we will be paying attention to that.
The Walmart property's original zoning allowed any type of big box store, including a wholesale merchandiser like Costco. In the mid-90s, when the new Max light rail line came in, county planners refocused their planning around the new form of transportation. They decided to zone properties as far out as a half mile from the station for transit-oriented development. But the focus for those further out properties, like the Walmart one, would not be access to the transit line, but rather design. This change outlawed wholesale stores like Costco, but allowed other types of commercial use. Washington County Principal Planner Andy Back.
It's hard to distinguish a potential Walmart from a potential Nordstrom's or a potential Meijer and Frank or a potential Target. They're all sort of department stores that you sort of have to make a decision. Are you going to allow those uses or not?
Save Cedar Mill activists would hardly agree. But while anti-Walmart folks say the store would ruin the neighborhood, what really is the neighborhood? Cedar Mill is its own community with a long history, some very well-established residents, a business association, and a monthly newsletter. Local historian Virginia Bruce describes who's been living in Cedar Mill over the years.
In the beginning, they were loggers, and that was what basically drove the economy. Once everything was logged, they were farmers. I like to say that we sent our logs over to build Portland, and then we sent our vegetables over to feed Portland, and now we house Portland.
But many people in the area don't have Bruce's understanding for the region. Over the last 15 years, there's been a huge influx of residents to Washington County. How do planners cope with such growth while trying to maintain the livability of the community? Beaverton's Director of Community Development, Joe Grillo.
Right now, there's probably a lot of people that would define livability. If I have a job, life is good. If I don't have a job, life is probably not so good. There's just a huge listing of items which can be compressed down into what's livability, and I'm not sure that any one person's definition of livability is more correct than anybody else's.
The larger demand is still to have your single-family house and to make those things walkable and bicycle friendly if you can.
Washington County Principal Planner Andy Back.
The fundamental market forces are still there. People still prefer to drive a car than hop on a bus or walk, and people still really enjoy living in single-family homes, and it's tough to overcome the impacts of those. If those are the community choices, then there are going to be impacts there.
We should be encouraging more village-like constructions. And I tell you, they're getting successful everywhere else. The small businesses and people are walking to them. I think people want that. And they're not getting a chance to do that out here because you've got these basically strip malls and large box things that just don't work that way.
That's former Metro Chief and Cedar Mill resident Mike Burton. The developments Burton is describing are all in Portland, and Beaverton Community Development Director Grillo notes that Portland subsidizes such development.
We also are not, at this point, heavily subsidizing, if you will, or underwriting housing, which certainly has been something that has made many of the projects in Portland go forward, whether it's in terms of, you know, tax abatement or significant land cost write-down or infrastructure improvements. This community and other communities out here are probably not at that point yet.
But why not? Is it the role of local planners to direct and shape people's housing and transportation choices? Or is that better left to market forces? For the Whole Communities Radio Project, I'm Miriam Widman, KBOO News.
Americano?
You know, years ago when I first come in here in 72, we had all the same things, but it was cabins rather than lounges. People nowadays, especially the younger people nowadays, they just like coffee. They drink that espresso coffee like it's party gone north, you know.
That's Joseph Benjamin. His is one of the last of the old taverns left on Alberta Street in Northeast Portland. After 33 years, Joe's Place is closing its doors so that Benjamin can retire and lease out the space. He has watched three decades of change on Alberta Street. 30 years ago, it was one of the commercial centers of Portland's African-American community. But by the early 80s, it was a street where no one felt safe, and many of the businesses were closed.
The only thing I could say that I did differently, I hung on longer than the other. A lot of things that really, really tore this neighborhood up when they started gangbanging around here, and that's what really made it bad. A lot of the people sold out. I was just determined that I wasn't going to run.
This very intersection on 14th Place was like the number one intersection for drive-by shootings 10, 15 years ago.
Jeanette Caden and her business partner opened the Tin Shed Garden Cafe on Alberta Street 4 years ago in a location formerly occupied by Rosalind's Coffee Garden, one of the first businesses that opened 12 years ago, awakening a renaissance on Alberta Street.
I don't really see any crime anymore, and that's good. Vacant, vandalized, boarded-up buildings are now vibrant living businesses and residences and art galleries.
Portland is a very segregated town, and this is the black part of town, or at least it was, and it used to be that white folks were not necessarily welcome here, and then something changed.
Video animator and artist Zach Margolis has lived in the Alberta neighborhood for several years.
Some poor sort of white artists start moving in because it's a place that they can afford, and they start making it safe for people with a little bit more money to come in. One thing leads to another, and suddenly it's a place that's not affordable anymore.
Some of the most visible artists in the neighborhood live in the Clown House, just up the street from Joe's Place. Caffeine Jones is one of the clowns who says she hardly recognizes the street just 2 years after moving in.
I came back here to raise my daughter in this area because I wanted her to grow up with the perspective that I grew up with. I wanted her to have a lot of different people around her, you know, and not just like sort of one type of person, or live in a kind of neighborhood where everybody in the neighborhood has, you know, the same income level or whatever. And it's just disappearing.
The neighborhood has changed. It has definitely gentrified.
Christy Pearson-Dunning was a part of a buying club that became the Alberta Street Food Co-op.
When we bought our house 17 years ago, it was $32,000. Now, the houses on our street are selling for $250,000, $300,000. All the poor people are being driven out of the neighborhood unless they own their homes. And the people who started the buying club basically were part of the, for lack of a better word, the gentrification of this neighborhood. It was a bunch of Caucasian sort of hippies, and that's not what this neighborhood was originally.
Dingo the Clown, a longtime Clown House resident, offers one possible solution.
As soon as I heard our rent was going to go up, I was going to go get a whole bunch of macadamia nuts and put them in little baggies and just strew them all over the neighborhood. Maybe turn it back into a crack neighborhood, because then it'd be affordable. But I think that's illegal.
It's not just us. It's not just affecting us, but all over Portland and in a lot of other cities, too, there's this move toward sort of cleaning up these inner city areas.
The relative merits of such cleanup projects is a hot topic of debate along Alberta Street.
This whole neighborhood is becoming extremely white, just like the rest of Portland.
Aisha Khazul recently opened Zaytuna, a bar that also serves Lebanese food, in a brand new building at 22nd and Alberta. She says graffiti on the walls of the new place let her know what people thought right away.
Someone had sprayed yuppie scum and all of that. Now, people don't know anything about me. They don't know I'm from Iraq. They don't know that the owner of the bar is a woman. Some people don't know that. They don't know that I'm a lesbian. They don't need to know anything about my background. They simply know that I'm opening a bar in Alberta, and they don't like it. And because of that, they're not going to like me. I am part of gentrification, and I don't like that, but I am a part of it.
The Clowns have heard a lot of people complain about them, mostly anonymously, for bringing the first wave of gentrification to Alberta Street.
Somebody actually said, why don't you go to Tacoma and raise their property values?
There may be people on Alberta Street who don't like living and working next door to circus performers, but many people feel they bring a much-needed creative element to the changing culture of the street.
What made the street so memorable and really give it its character is the Clown House. That, to me, is what defined Alberta. That, to me, is why I came to Alberta, because of people like Dingo and his friends who are so amazing to watch and so talented. And they're being pushed out.
As the first wave of new residents starts to feel uncomfortable, many are speculating about what the street will look like in another 5 or 10 years. Zach Margolis.
It seems like it's inevitable that eventually it's going to turn into a Hawthorne or a Northwest 23rd or a Belmont.
It feels like community here. Like you go to Northwest 23rd and it's somehow void of any human heart and character. And I think Alberta still has that.
Joseph Benjamin says he feels like the business community was much more close-knit when the street was lined with taverns.
I remember back in the days when, if I had a real slow night, I'd have 4 or 5 of my regular customers in here. Hell, we'd close up and go down to one of the bars down the street. I knew every owner from Martin Luther King to 29th. And we had a lot of fun back then. It isn't like that anymore.
While old-timers like Joseph Benjamin feel that the community they knew and felt a part of has disappeared, the neighborhood is in flux, and a new kind of community is forming among the current residents and business owners.
People seem to know each other and recognize each other and make that effort and go out of their way to get to know who their neighbors are. And that is amazing. That's why the city is not a city. It's a big town, you know, or a gigantic village.
For the Whole Communities Radio Project, this is Julie Sabatier.
The constant muffled roar of the interstate freeway mixed with car fumes and the brownish haze permeate the plaza apartments. This 28-year-old federally subsidized low-income housing project is in the heart of North Portland. For the 32 families of the plaza apartments located between Interstate 5 and the Cascade campus of Portland Community College, traffic and industrial fumes are an expensive price to pay for having a place to live and take a shower.
If it wasn't for the fact that, you know, I'm on welfare and that I have a kid, I wouldn't qualify to be here. And second of all, it wouldn't be a place that I would choose to live.
Plaza resident Andera Harris is a single mother.
I had to move my daughter out of my room because we just kept getting sick. We stayed sick all the time.
We have 68 apartments here. 34 3-bedrooms, 34 2-bedrooms.
Sylvia Evans, a single mother, has lived at the Plaza Apartments for 17 years.
We're home to Somalian, Ethiopian, Oromo, African-American, American-Indian, Caucasian. We got a little bit of everything here.
Sylvia has become the voice of the Plaza Town residents, in their battles with agencies like the Housing Authority of Portland, which oversees low-income housing projects in the city.
Well, if you look this way, we're one block from the I-5 freeway. And, you know, roughly 65,000 cars, trucks, and other motor vehicles travel that freeway, spewing their toxins in our neighborhood. What the air toxic result that PSU recently did showed us is that this side of the freeway is a lot worse than the other side of the freeway, mainly because of the way the wind blows. And then the way that the buildings are set up here, you would think that since there's a little bit of space between each building, like roughly 4 feet, that we would get a really nice airflow, but we don't. The buildings actually help trap the air toxins in the middle of our complex, which is also where our playground is. We just want people to be aware that there's a whole bunch of us that live along this freeway, and we have to clean up the freeway in order for us to be able to clean up our environment so we can breathe easier and no more lanes on the freeway. We need to come up with alternate modes of transportation to try to take the commuters off of that freeway.
There's a whole other set of problems coming from the ground upon which the apartments sit, dating back to the late 1800s, when the North Portland area was full of railroad yards and factories dumping their waste into the nearby Willamette River. On a table, Sylvia and other plaza residents look at turn-of-the-century photographs of their neighborhood.
We were a railroad yard. Streetcars used to be housed here. They would bring them here, they would fix them, store them here. What this means for us is that a lot of petroleum and other products were used on the site. Back in the early 70s, they didn't have the EPA regulations or Superfund to clean up toxic waste sites so that you could use them for housing or businesses or whatever. So back in the 70s, the only thing they did was encapsulate us, pour down concrete, and then build on top of the concrete. The problem is that all those chemicals are now coming up through the ground. So all around us, we have toxic air. And then when you get inside your home, and we don't have proper ventilation inside the home, so all these gases get trapped in your home. And then that's what triggers asthma, respiratory conditions.
I used to live on 10th and Ainsworth. When I moved from there to here, I wasn't sick.
Lucille McDonald and her family have lived at the plaza for at least 15 years. The second sound you hear in the background is her oxygen respirator.
And I stayed here for about a good year and a half. And I noticed that going up the stairs, I couldn't breathe. And it got worse and worse. I went to the doctor, and they found a spot on my lungs, and they don't know what it is. And I've never been sick like this, you know. Every day that you wake up, you got a headache, your runny eyes, you're sneezing, you don't have the energy to get up and do anything, and it's scary.
The air the plaza residents breathe is toxic. The soil the apartments are built upon leach poison, but staying inside doesn't solve the problem either. Sylvia shakes her head with determination.
Asbestos, yes. It's located in all the bedrooms, the living room, and the dining room. The problem is that because of the attics and the leaks that we've had for years, the mold and mildew is coming through onto the asbestos. And then we're being told that that's a housekeeping issue, and it's not. A resident shouldn't be cleaning that asbestos off. We are not equipped with the education on how to deal with that. So a lot of folks, it's just there, and they're wondering why they're having breathing issues.
We have problem for the breathing. There are a lot of people that live in Plaza Town. They have asthma.
Saliad Ahmed, 8-year resident of the plaza.
Yeah, I told him, explain to my doctor, for it's my son. He say, we do, you know, keep your medication for. We explain we live in Plaza Town, 3-bedroom, small housing. He say, not clean. I explained, he said, we have no solution to do nothing.
The families of the Plaza Apartments over the past decade have painfully learned that it is up to them to decide how to deal with the poisons around them. Like Sylvia Evans, they don't have to be afraid now to speak out.
I hear people tell me every day, well, it's low-income housing. What do you expect? So I ask them, what do you expect out of your tax money? What do you think is paying for this? You know, you want to be angry because your tax money is going to schools that are not functioning properly or that are going to, you know, things that are not earth-friendly that you really are upset about. But you're not upset when it comes to people living in these kind of substandard and life-threatening conditions.
For the whole community's radio project, I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra.
Portland, Oregon is a city surrounded by two mighty rivers, the Willamette and the Columbia. It's also a city built on creeks. As this town grew into a city, it buried more and more miles of creeks by building massive infrastructure on top of them. How do urban streams affect the health of rivers, wildlife, and people? Mike Hauk with the Urban Green Spaces Institute has been an advocate for protecting nature in the city. He focuses on how urban design issues relate to natural resources. I asked him about the importance of streams in the urban environment.
They form the most significant element of the ribbons of green, the green infrastructure system of the city. They carry floodwaters to the larger system of rivers, the Willamette and the Columbia River. There's no other element of the landscape that's as rich in diversity of plant, fish, and other animal life than stream corridors.
Historically, there were a tremendous number of streams in Portland.
Bob Salinger is the Urban Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society.
This really is correctly named the River City, and the tributaries of the Willamette were extensive on both sides of the river, but many, many of them have been put underground into culverts. Today we have over 388 miles of streams in culverts in the metropolitan region.
Metro, in collaboration with the Bureau of Environmental Services here in Portland, produced a map called the Disappearing Streams Map, which shows some 400 miles of streams running underground in the Portland metropolitan area and the region. Mike Hauk.
When people see and realize how many miles of streams we put underground, they say, oh my God, I had no idea that streams were there in the past. This is particularly true for the Columbia Slough. I also have not encountered a single issue that strikes the imagination of the general public as the whole concept of daylighting streams, bringing them above ground and exposing them to the urban environment.
What would it look like if more streams that once meandered through the city were allowed to breathe again? When the Pearl District was being developed, engineers seriously considered daylighting Tanner Creek, which runs off the West Hills near the zoo, down the Tualatin Mountains and through the Pearl District. It was decided that it just wasn't feasible. What got built instead were Tanner Springs Park and Jameson Square, both located in the heart of the Pearl District. Again, Mike Hauk.
That water that's ebbing and flowing represents the fact that there is a stream underground there.
Although parks such as Jameson Square, with its creatively designed water fountain features, can evoke the energies of water on the surface that we, as inhabitants of the urban environment, can interact with, it still isn't a natural, free-flowing body of water. But you don't have to hang out in culverts to experience some of Portland's creeks. Balch Creek in Forest Park and Johnson Creek, which flows along much of the Springwater Corridor Trail, are two creeks you can visit. Michelle Bussard, Executive Director of the Johnson Creek Watershed Council.
Johnson Creek meanders 26 miles from its headwaters near Boring through a very rural countryside through and into a more densely populated floodplain and then on into Portland to the confluence with the Willamette at Milwaukee. We've got salmon that are returning, migrating, and spawning. Johnson Creek is one of the last free-flowing streams within the Portland metropolitan area, which is to say we don't have as many traditional daylighting issues as other creeks might have. The bigger issue for Johnson Creek are what we would traditionally call fish passage barriers. These are dams and culverts.
Portland is lucky to have some urban streams still above ground. One beneficial function that stream corridors provide is critical habitat for birds, fish, and other wildlife.
We've got a very robust lamprey eel population, which was considered for ESA, Endangered Species Act listing. The lamprey eel was traditionally an ancient food source for Native Americans that traveled this watershed. In addition to that, we know that we've got coyote, deer, possum, raccoon, a lot of animals that have been able to adapt to human behaviors.
There are important decisions to be made right now as to how Portland gets developed in order to accommodate its burgeoning population. We know that creeks and streams aid in the absorption of stormwater, providing natural and free ways to deal with urban runoff. Green infrastructure has economic benefits. Right now, the city of Portland is spending $1.4 billion on the Big Pipe. Bob Salinger, Portland Audubon Society.
The Big Pipe is the largest works project in the history of Oregon. And what this essentially deals with is the fact that we have raw sewage in our rivers. It's not that big of a pipe. And the reality is, if we don't start dealing with stormwater on site, things like daylighting creeks, putting in bioswales, roof gardens, increasing our tree canopy, the Big Pipe will be obsolete within a generation or two. And if we don't learn to develop cities in a way that's ecologically sensitive, we're going to continue to see species decline. Stream corridors are, without question, the most biologically rich areas of any environment.
Will the city hold on to its existing green infrastructure, and will it put creative ideas, energy, and monies into recreating more? Right now, there's an underground network of waterways flowing beneath us, out of sight, but it doesn't need to be out of mind. For the Whole Communities Radio Project, this is Kayleen Chassie.
And we've been listening to four features that were produced for the Whole Communities Radio Project, a special project KBOO has been running for the last couple of years, funded by Sound Partners for Community Health. And if you want to learn more about the Whole Communities Radio Project, you can go to our website, www.wholecommunitiesradio.org, and click on programming. You can listen to all the archives of the different panels we've been running since April 2005, listen to all the features, these four, and a whole lot of other features. And I want to thank Eduardo, Miriam, Julie, and Kayleen, and all the other mentees, interns in this project who did such excellent work. Now, coming up on KBOO, we're going to hear three reports from a series Between the Lines. We'll be hearing reports on detainee treatment, a disaster for human rights, also reactions to Hugo Chavez's UN speech, and finally a victory for wilderness defenders in a federal court. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, Senator Patrick Leahy and Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights react to yesterday's decision by the Senate to give President Bush extraordinary power to detain and try prisoners in the so-called War on Terror. And an interview with author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, a behind-the-scenes account of the Bush administration's appointees who ran Iraq after the U.S. invasion.
Subvert KBOO's upcoming membership drive by renewing your membership in our fall sweepstakes, where you could be the lucky winner of a $2,000 shopping spree all around Portland. KBOO is offering $200 gift certificates from 10 local businesses as the sweepstakes prize. These businesses include Bike Central Co-op, Buffalo Gardens, Cotton Cloud Futons and Furniture, Higgins Restaurant and Bar, Mirador Community Store, Oregon Mountain Community, Portland Saturday Market, The Rebuilding Center, Spa Wilhelmina, and Susan Hebert Imports. If you're a KBOO member, you should have already received your entry form in the mail. Entering KBOO's fall sweepstakes is easy, but you can't win if you don't enter.
In a flurry of activity just 6 weeks before the midterm congressional election, Republican U.S. Senators McCain, Warner, and Graham negotiated a deal with President Bush to propose new legislation establishing acceptable interrogation techniques for terrorist suspects and the guidelines under which they could be tried in military commissions. The new measure was made necessary after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the president's previous rules governing military commissions, citing violations of the U.S. Constitution and the Geneva Convention protections for detainees. But according to civil liberties advocates, the compromise allows President Bush to issue his own interpretation of the Geneva Conventions by executive order and provides immunity to CIA and military personnel for past violations. The proposed law would also eliminate the right of detainees to challenge the legality of their detention through habeas corpus, a fundamental right guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. The case of Canadian citizen Mahar Arar is an example of such abuse. While returning home to Canada from a family vacation in 2002, Arar was detained, interrogated, and then sent to a torture cell in Syria by the Bush administration. He remained in prison under brutal conditions for 10 months before being released. The Canadian government recently issued a report finding that Mr. Arar had committed no crime. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Marjorie Cohn, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, who explains why she believes the Senate White House compromise on detainee treatment is a disaster for human rights and the rule of law.
Senators McCain, Warner, and Graham were ostensibly holding out for a more just piece of legislation, but this so-called compromise that they have struck with the White House actually has the most insidious and, I believe, unconstitutional provisions left intact. I think perhaps the most serious of which is the elimination of habeas corpus review for all non-U.S. citizen detainees. The Constitution is very clear that the only time that Congress can suspend habeas corpus is when there is a threat of rebellion or invasion, which we don't have. Nobody is rebelling or invading the U.S., or if there is a danger to public safety. And the enemy detainees at Guantanamo Bay, the alleged enemy detainees, were all picked up overseas, and they are in a very secure place in Guantanamo Bay, 90 miles from our shore. So they're not going anywhere. And as Senator Arlen Specter says and Senator Patrick Leahy, there is no justification. In fact, it's unconstitutional for Congress to suspend habeas corpus the way it has.
What about some of the other provisions that were negotiated, such as giving the president the right to determine what the Geneva Convention says, having him really make the definition himself?
That's a good point. Under our federal war crimes statute, which is a U.S. law, people can be prosecuted for war crimes, and war crimes have always, under that particular war crimes statute, which was enacted by a Republican Congress, by the way, war crimes have included violations of Common Article 3. Common Article 3, Bush had maintained, did not apply to our war with al-Qaeda. But the Supreme Court in the Hamdan case in June said, yes, indeed, it does. So what the so-called compromise between Bush and these three senators does is to narrow the scope of war crimes under our War Crimes Act. It's no longer all violations of Common Article 3, but rather just ones that have been listed in this new so-called compromise. And it excludes outrages upon personal dignity, that is, humiliating and degrading treatment, which is, I think, what our CIA and much of our military actually does in Iraq, Guantanamo, and Afghanistan and elsewhere. And now that cannot be punished as a war crime. And the other part of Common Article 3 that has always been punishable as a war crime under our war crime statute, which this so-called compromise excludes as a war crime, is sentencing and execution of prisoners without a regularly constituted court with all the judicial guarantees recognized as indispensable by civilized people. That's the provision of Common Article 3 that the Hamdan case was all about. So what this does is to give the president, in this case Bush, the power to decide what, besides the listed violations, which are torture and murder and cruel treatment and rape, etc., can be punishable as war crimes. And, of course, he's not going to decide that any are, because he doesn't want his people or himself, under the doctrine of command responsibility, prosecuted.
Specify for us, if you would, the immunity that this compromise legislation offers members of the CIA, the military, and the executive branch.
Well, it's retroactive, and it says no criminal liability for any of this. It goes back to September 11th. But it lets them off the hook. And, you know, one other thing that I should mention is that, you know how the government likes to talk about collateral damage when, you know, hundreds of civilians are killed in a military operation or there are allegations that our military has actually targeted civilians? Well, this particular so-called compromise actually says that collateral damage doesn't constitute a war crime.
Marjorie, in closing, I'd like to ask you this. What do you suppose the international reaction will be if Congress does indeed pass this new version of the detainee guidelines for terrorist suspects here in the United States? What will be the ripple effect internationally, do you think?
I think it will give tremendous ammunition to people in other countries who say that the United States government does not practice what it preaches, that it holds people indefinitely for the rest of their lives. They can't go into a court. The government is all powerful. It's like a dictatorship. And they can be mistreated and humiliated and degraded, and yet there's no relief. I think it's going to hurt us in this war on terror that that Bush says he's fighting. The National Intelligence Estimate has already come out and said that the war in Iraq has really hurt us in the war on terror, made us much less safe, turned it into a bastion of terrorism. And I think this is just going to add more fuel to the fire, and people are going to point out the hypocrisy on behalf of the U.S. government. And it could also backfire when our soldiers are captured by other countries. And they'll say, look, the U.S., look at how they treat their prisoners. We're not going to treat Americans humanely either. And I think it's going to hurt us all the way around. And the only people it's going to protect are the interrogators, the CIA officials, and Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld and company.
That was Marjorie Cohen, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and president-elect of the National Lawyers Guild. Contact the National Lawyers Guild at area code 212-627-2656 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. In a speech like few others delivered at the United Nations, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez forcefully attacked President Bush and U.S. policies around the world. American TV and newspapers provided saturation coverage of Chavez's reference to Mr. Bush as the devil, while ignoring major points made during the populist Latin American leader's address. Democratic Party House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Representative Charles Rangel joined Republican politicians and conservative pundits in condemning Chavez for disrespecting the U.S. president. But U.N. delegates boisterously applauded Chavez's speech, which included denouncing the U.S.-supported Israeli war against Lebanon, calls for an end to what he described as the anti-democratic veto power held by five nations in the U.N. Security Council, and exposing Washington's double standard and support for right-wing terrorists in Latin America. Chavez also repeated his assertion that President Bush had supported an unsuccessful military coup against his government in 2002. The war of words at the United Nations momentarily overshadowed the U.S. conflict with Iran and highlighted Venezuela's current efforts to win a non-permanent seat on the U.N. Security Council, a bid vigorously opposed by the White House. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ian Williams, U.N. correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses international reaction to Chavez's speech.
Well, I think his language about the devil and the sulfurousness, the smell of sulfur in the hall, might have been a little over the top. But he wasn't trying to address an American audience. He knows that whatever happens, the Fox press and the Murdoch press, the Fox and the Murdoch aren't going to give him any leg room, nor is any of the rest of the media, since they seem to follow the administration's cue on this. So to some extent, that detracted from the truth to power bit from the rest of the speech. But he's not playing to the U.S. press. He's playing to the third world. He's playing to the mass of people out there, and they loved every moment of it, if the reaction of the delegates is anything to go by. But the false indignation, I mean, these people have been calling for his overthrow. They financed coups. They've made him honorary part of the Axis of Evil. They arrested his foreign minister at the airport. They kept half of his entourage on the plane and refused to let them off. And then they wonder that he actually shouts back at them. It is a sort of stunning. You know, this animal is dangerous. When attacked, it fights back. neither he nor Ahmadinejad is attempting to speak to the American media, luckily. What they're speaking to is to a huge audience out in the developing world, and there, of course, they were playing to the gallery and winning big applause. And whereas Bush's speech was so patently in orbit and out of touch with reality, you could you really have to wonder who wrote it for him, what planet they were on.
Venezuela has hopes of gaining a temporary seat on the UN Security Council. Do you think overall Chavez's speech and his blunt talk against the Bush administration will help or hurt his chances to get that seat in the contest between the U.S.-backed government of Guatemala against Venezuela?
I'm not sure. I think he sort of gains as many votes as he loses on it, because he didn't exactly observe the protocols, but it was quite clear from the applause in the hall that a lot of people were delighted with what he said and did. Once again, playing to the gallery, and the gallery, for once, actually votes here. When in a contested election, the whole membership of the General Assembly votes by secret ballot. So it has happened before that the United States has opposed people, and it has ricocheted on them. You know, the U.S. actually, one year, under Madeleine Albright, never mind John Bolton, lost a seat on the Human Rights Council because people were so... was so disgruntled with being hectored and lectured by the U.S. that even America's best friend took the opportunity of the secret ballot to vote against.
There are many commentators in the United States after the Chavez speech that said Chavez's blunt words against Bush will help President Bush and the Republicans in their run-up to this midterm congressional election. And, of course, you had Democratic Party Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Charles Rangel of New York, both in Congress, attacking Chavez, basically trying to distance themselves from the Venezuelan leader. What, if any, impact do you think this will have on election year politics?
I don't think it'll have too much. I don't think that I don't think the administration has actually succeeded yet in sort of demonizing Chavez to the extent that they have with Castro and the others. They're trying very hard. And, you know, we keep forgetting this guy has been elected several times, is almost certain to be elected next time. All the polls show he's intensely popular in Venezuela, so he isn't. You know, frankly, I think he does himself discredit by going so close to some unelected dictators in there. He would be much better off standing up on his own and standing up with Lula and the other Latin American people who've been elected. He's different. You might disagree, and you might worry that he's got some sort of strongman tendencies, but at the moment he's elected, and he's been re-elected consistently.
You think the UN is headed for different times after Kofi Annan? Do you think there'll be a different tone there after he leaves, and who do you think will succeed him?
It's almost impossible to say at the moment. The US will oppose almost any decent candidate, but the candidates are, most of them, they're sort of forced by their circumstances. They can't bow down to what America wants and have any integrity for themselves or the organization. So no matter who's put in, and we must remember that Kofi Annan was an American nomination. But in the end, he was a principled person who had to stand for principles. And when America went wrong, he said so, even though he's done his best to engage both America and Israel in the process over the last 10 years.
That was Ian Williams, author of United Nations for Beginners, published by Writers and Readers. Read his articles on the United Nations in the pages of The Nation magazine and online at www.thenation.com. In January of 2001, just before leaving office, President Bill Clinton instituted the so-called Roadless Rule to protect 58.5 million acres of federal wilderness areas in the West from development. The Bush administration has been working to overturn the rule ever since so that roads could be built and extractive industries, timber, oil, and gas, can extend their reach into these remote areas. Last year, the White House rescinded the old rule, but put a less restrictive one in its place, in which governors of western states have much more control over the use of these almost 60 million acres. but a coalition of 20 environmental groups, both local and national, sued the Bush administration, as did four Western states. They were supported by 1 million citizens who submitted comments in favor of the roadless rule. And last week, a federal district judge in California overturned the Bush regulation, saying the Forest Service had not followed its own regulations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Todd True, a staff attorney with Earth Justice, which represents the Environmental Coalition. He talks about the importance of this ruling, which may or may not be appealed by the Bush administration to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
The federal government actually has not really done anything so far in terms of appealing the ruling or taking steps like that. They have said to the judge in California that they believe her decision only applies going forward and that there are some road building or other activities in roadless areas that had been approved that they think should proceed. Now, we were in court with the judge arguing that her decision should apply to all of the activities that would be prohibited by this 2001 rule, and we've got some further briefing to go there, and she will presumably make a decision about exactly how her ruling is going to apply to projects that the Bush administration allowed to go forward while it was in the process of repealing this rule.
Any idea how many projects that is or how many miles?
The number of projects are in the low two digits. They're scattered around the West, and probably some of the larger scale ones involve leasing of undeveloped roadless lands for oil and gas development. Those are probably some of the more significant ones that you'll be looking at.
Todd True, what Bush wanted was that the governors of these Western states would have more of a say than the federal government. That seems more democratic in a way. What's wrong with that?
They did have a say, and they did comment on this rule. What the thing about these areas that is unique is that they are national forests. They are not state forests, and so people in New York have an interest in and a legitimate concern about how the wilderness in the West is managed. And more importantly, perhaps, or as importantly, over the last three or four decades, what the Forest Service said it had discovered is that if you leave management of these special areas to sort of a case-by-case national forest or state-by-state decision-making process, they will get whittled away bit by bit because no one is looking at that bigger picture. And when they looked at that bigger picture, they said, you know, we've got, for example, 386,000 miles of logging roads on our national forests already. We can't take care of the environmental problems those roads are causing, and we need to protect the places that don't have roads across them at a national level because they're a unique resource.
What about the impact on endangered species if the Bush plan were put in place? Didn't the judge mention that in her ruling also?
It's a similar point. If these areas are managed sort of piece by piece, then the ecosystems that support some of our endangered species, whether they're big ones like grizzly bear or fish like salmon, the ecosystems that support those species are going to be eroded. And these roadless areas are really important sort of reservoirs, savings accounts for those species because they're the last places that haven't been logged and eroded and where the water is clean and pure and it's great for salmon spawning or where the hand of man is not so visible and grizzly bears can roam across the kinds of areas that they need to survive. So, yes, the concern was that returning these areas to sort of management by different states at different levels at different in different ways would actually cause problems for a lot of these species. The court didn't say you can't have some flexibility in your rules or anything like that. It just said the wholesale repeal of this rule by the Bush administration, this rule that protected these areas, didn't follow the law.
What role, if any, did the conservative groups in the West play that were part of the Sagebrush Rebellion in the 1980s, which tried to roll back environmental protections?
Well, there were a number of lawsuits filed against the original rule to protect these areas, some of them by different industry groups, coalitions of off-road vehicle users or the timber industry or the mining interests. And so they apparently did not, from their economic perspective, like this rule, even though as I say, you know, well over a million individuals around the country wrote in and commented that this rule is really what's needed to protect these lands. Whether they have more or less clout today, I don't know, but it's certainly true that the Bush administration has been busy trying to reopen the public lands to exploitation by oil and gas interests and other folks who are interested in resource extraction and not in balanced stewardship of these lands.
That was Todd True, an attorney with Earth Justice. Contact the group by calling area code 510-550-6700 or visit their website at www.earthjustice.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
It's 10:56 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 11 on Democracy Now!, Senator Patrick Leahy and Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights react to yesterday's decision by the Senate to give President Bush extraordinary power to detain and try prisoners in the so-called War on Terror. And an interview with the author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, a behind-the-scenes account of the Bush administration appointees who ran Iraq after the U.S. invasion. Also, here's an announcement about something happening this weekend. There will be a special KBOO Board of Directors meeting. It's called for Saturday, September 30th, from 1:45 p.m. to 2 p.m. The location is not at KBOO. It's at the Nocturnal Lounge, located at 1800 East Burnside. There is only one agenda item, to approve KBOO reaffiliation with the Pacifica Foundation. The board meeting will adjourn at 2 p.m. for the annual KBOO Foundation meeting, also at Nocturnal, from 2 to 5:30 p.m. Results of the election and the bylaws vote will be announced at that meeting. And right now we're going to hear some music and then go to Democracy Now! In just a couple minutes. Thank you.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
I have been told by the U.S. administration that I cannot enter the country because I donated money to an organization which is suspected in the state. The problem is that I gave this money 1 year before this organization was blacklisted. So how should I have known that this organization was suspected? This is nonsense.
Tariq Ramadan, the renowned Swiss Muslim scholar, was blocked from entering the United States to teach at the University of Notre Dame. He'll join us from Oxford in England, where he was allowed to enter. But first, we go to California, where a landmark global warming bill has been signed into law, and we'll be joined by the mayor of Albuquerque, Martin Chavez. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration's controversial military commissions and detainee treatment bill is one step closer to being signed into law. On Wednesday, the House approved its version of the measure, leaving it to a vote in the Senate today.
We're going to switch this feature of Democracy Now! Because we think we have the wrong date on. So we're going to hopefully go to today's version.
Today, we take a look at groundbreaking legislation. The Senate has agreed.
I can't tell because this is supposed to be the right one. It's 29.
It gives the president the power to indefinitely detain anyone it deems to have provided material support to anti-U.S. hostilities. Secret and coerced evidence could be used to try detainees held in U.S. military prisons. The bill also immunizes U.S. officials from prosecution for torturing detainees who the military and the CIA captured before the end of last year. The Senate passed the measure 65-34. 12 Democrats joined the Republican majority. The House passed virtually the same legislation Wednesday. Legal groups, including the Center for Constitutional Rights, are already preparing to challenge the constitutionality of the law in court. We will speak with Senator Patrick Leahy and CCR President Michael Ratner after headlines. In other news from Capitol Hill, the House has voted to rewrite the country's domestic wiretap laws to accommodate the Bush administration's warrantless spying. The bill would change current law requiring a court order for the monitoring of incoming or outgoing communications in the United States. Court orders would be required only if a phone call or email occurred within the U.S. Critics say that will lead to increased surveillance of citizens without court approval. A competing bill awaits a Senate vote. Meanwhile, the Bush administration's secret monitoring of international financial transactions has been dealt a major setback in Europe. On Thursday, the Belgian government said the program is illegal and will have to be changed. Belgium is the home to the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, or SWIFT. The organization helps direct trillions of dollars in international bank transfers each day. The decision comes on the heels of a major report from Belgium's Privacy Commission that says SWIFT improperly gave data on millions of transactions to U.S. officials. Venezuela is pleading for international help in its bid to extradite a former CIA operative wanted for the killing of dozens of people. On Thursday, Foreign Minister Nicolas Maduro said his government has asked UN Security Council to intervene in the case Luis Posada Carriles. He is wanted for the 1976 bombing of a Cuban passenger flight that killed 73 people. He's been detained in the United States after illegally entering last year. Carriles could soon be freed, but the Bush administration says it won't send him back to Cuba or Venezuela. Meanwhile, Venezuela's foreign minister also says his government is facing new resistance from the U.S. over its attempt to join the UN Security Council.
As you will know, the debate is not with Guatemala. Our debate is rather with Condoleezza Rice. You should know by now that it is the U.S. government that is doing its best and putting pressure in order to prevent Venezuela from becoming a member of the Security Council. They are desperate. Condoleezza Rice personally left her schedule aside and has dedicated herself to this alone.
That's Foreign Minister Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela. The Bush administration says it's suspending military aid to Thailand in the aftermath of last week's military coup. The new military regime has banned political parties from staging rallies or conducting any other activity and imposed new curbs on the media. State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick spoke Thursday in Washington.
The United States continues to urge a rapid return to democratic rule and early elections in Thailand. We look forward to being able to reinstate these suspended programs after a democratically elected government takes office.
In Canada, the head of the National Police has apologized to Maher Arar. Arar is the Canadian citizen who the U.S. abducted and sent to a Syrian prison where he was tortured. Last week, the Canadian government exonerated Arar, criticized both the Canadian and U.S. officials for his ordeal. In a statement Thursday, Royal Canadian Mounted Police Commissioner Giuliano Zaccardelli said his force had made major mistakes and caused terrible injustices to Arar. The Guardian of London reports senior military officials are increasing calls for the withdrawal of British troops from Iraq. The officials say Iraq is unwinnable and want efforts focused on Afghanistan, where there is still a chance. Senior leaders have also reportedly become alarmed over opinion polls showing the dwindling support for the war and how that is impacting troops' morale and recruitment. A newly leaked memo from the Pentagon, a military think tank, says, quote, British armed forces are effectively held hostage in Iraq. We are now fighting and arguably losing or potentially losing on two fronts. That from a Defense Department memo. A new account of the White House's handling of Iraq and the war on terror says President Bush ignored an urgent warning on the growing Iraqi insurgency in the months after the invasion. In a new book, Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, President Bush told top advisors, quote, I don't want anyone in the cabinet to say it is an insurgency. I don't think we are there yet. That instruction came in November 2003 when there were more than 700 attacks on U.S. troops. Woodward also reports former CIA Director George Tenet believed Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was hindering the development of a coherent strategy to capture or kill Osama bin Laden. In California, a four-day trial examining the legality of lethal injection heard testimony Thursday that prisoners may have remained conscious when administered a drug that induces suffocation. Mark Heath, a professor of anesthesiology at Columbia University Medical School, said state records show some executed prisoners were still breathing several minutes after they were given a paralytic agent used in California and three dozen other states. A congressional report has revealed new details on the ties between the White House and convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff. The House Government Committee says Abramoff and his associates had more than 400 contacts with White House officials over a three-year period. The number includes 9 direct contacts with the chief White House strategist, Karl Rove. Abramoff also secured a $16 million federal contract for one of his clients after reminding then-White House political director Ken Mellman of his client's donations to the Republican Party. And finally, in Los Angeles, close to 300 people were arrested Thursday in a street blockade supporting a unionization drive for hotel workers. Organizers are trying to unionize thousands of mostly immigrant workers at a dozen hotels around the Los Angeles International Airport. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're reporting from Albuquerque, New Mexico.